you sent me packing down in Green River Valley. I knew that if you couldn't, then no one would have me. Lost myself drinking with those stray dogs in the alleys till the whiskey sold my bones.
Hey, this is Mile High Stash, the podcast that asks what five albums you would take to a remote Colorado cabin in the event of a zombie apocalypse, armed with only food, water, and a crank-powered Victrola. And I'm Adam Perry. Summer is winding down, my kid's back in school, the nights are getting cooler, the presidential election is getting closer. I really hope that you vote for Kamala Harris, the former prosecutor, district attorney, attorney general, and senator, who grew up, you know, working at McDonald's to make ends meet, instead of the illiterate, orange, fraud, racist, rapist, and convicted felon, whose name I hope we don't have to hear again after November. Anyway, that is all of the politics for this episode, I promise. I just saw Tyler Childers play an incredible show at Folsom Field, and that was pretty special for a kid from Pittsburgh, who used to see Colorado football highlights on ESPN growing up and wonder what Boulder was like. Folsom Field is a beautiful setting with the Flatirons in the background and the sun going down. And our guest today is one of the modern experts at painting Flatirons in Boulder, and a lot of other beautiful settings. Remington Robinson, who I know as Rem, is a very talented and very viral painter of plein air art, which he generally does in the great outdoors inside of Altoid tins. I'm sure you've seen Rem's art on social media, and I hope that you check out Rem's new book, which we talk about. Rem is also a music geek, lots of different music, and that's one of the reasons I was excited to have him on Mile High Stash. I think Rem is the third visual artist that we've had. We talked about his five albums and his art. I love that Rem's art was partly inspired by hearing about guys in bars many, many years ago painting inside of cigar boxes and on whiskey bottles and stuff like that. Rem is awesome at capturing a scene, whether it's a mountain range or the Golden Gate in San Francisco or a street scene in Paris where Rem and his family are about to move. I will stop yapping now and just give you my conversation with painter Remington Robinson. You can check out his work at remingtonrobinson.com and on social media, Instagram chiefly. And you can check out more episodes of Mile High Stash at milehighstash.com or wherever you listen to stuff. Oh, and I will be playing the drums with Hunter Stone Band at the Fox Theater in Boulder on Sunday, September 22nd. It's a free concert to benefit Aldea Preschool in Boulder. So come say hi. All right. We will talk on the other side. I guess living the bad life, brother. Okay, Remington Robinson.
Perry.
You're from Ohio, right?
Yeah, I'm originally from Ohio.
Like outside of Cleveland?
Yep, from Chagrin Falls.
You go back like every year, don't you?
I probably go back at least once a year, maybe twice a year. Usually once a year at least.
Yeah. The last time I recorded an episode of this, I had my my dryer going. So this time there's a teenager walking around, you know, disturbing things. But that's what teenagers do. I've known you since our kids met, which was, I believe, in kindergarten, right?
Yeah, that seems about right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you are a visual artist and a amateur sound engineer.
I guess you could say that, yeah.
And very much a father. But I also want to ask you about the squirrel. You also have a squirrel.
Well, kind of. That squirrel bit me this morning.
The squirrel bit you this morning?
Well, we don't have it in our house. We did winter it over, or I guess, I don't know if that's what you call it. We had it in a cage inside our house over the winter last winter.
Yeah.
But it's been out since April, like out in the wild and living in the neighborhood. Coming back every so often to get some mixed nuts and blueberries and stuff.
Yeah. You guys are moving to Paris. So how much is the squirrel going to miss you, you know?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how much squirrels miss people.
Yeah.
We're going to tell the new tenant in our house to keep an eye out for the squirrel. And he seems kind of like a squirrely guy as well. So maybe he would be interested in feeding it.
This kind of reminds me of Andy Thorne, who was on the first season of the podcast. He plays the banjo in Leftover Salmon. Mm-hmm. And there is a fox that started coming to his house up in the foothills and just started coming back. But the squirrel was injured. That's why he kind of nursed it back to health.
Yeah, it was... I think it might have been a runt of the litter.
Yeah.
And it was like kicked out of the nest, or it couldn't get back up into its nest or something like. And Tara didn't want to see that happen. She didn't want to see the squirrel die. She took it home one day. Actually, I was kind of upset about it because I didn't really want to, you know, I kind of want to like let nature be.
Yeah.
But Squirrel Buddy. I like Squirrel Buddy.
Yeah. That's the name that you gave to it, Squirrel Buddy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's totally screwed. Like, you know, if nobody's feeding him,
right?
Like, I don't know what he's gonna do. He's probably gonna he's a goner.
Yeah.
He's got no instinct. Maybe a little bit of instinct.
When I was going to Naropa University, I remember. The squirrels were the fattest squirrels that I've ever seen because people just gave them like entire bagels, you know. Anyway, so you grew up in Cleveland and then you ended up in Colorado in order to go to art school, right?
Eventually, yeah. I basically really wanted to just leave Ohio because when I was 18, I didn't want to be in Ohio anymore.
Mm.
And I just wanted to get out of Ohio to go somewhere where I could snowboard.
Yeah,
and go fishing, and maybe do art so I could paint mountains, mountains and water, and Colorado was kind of one of those places that checked all the boxes, and I think I only applied to two schools, CU and University of Denver, and I went to CU for a few years, and then. Wasn't that great of a student, but went to CU, went on academic probation because I was such a bad student, just snowboarding all the time and just hanging out and not really doing school as much as I should have been, not taking it seriously. Then I was, then I brought my GPA up at Front Range Community College in Longmont. And then I did pretty well there. And then instead of going back to CU, I decided to transfer to Rocky Mountain College of Art and Design.
Right.
And then graduated from there in 2010.
And somehow in between, you know, then and now, you got really interested in this plein air.
Yeah, yeah.
Painting.
So when I was at Rocky Mountain College of Art and Design, I took a plein air painting class. That was probably fall of 2009,
mm-hmm.
With a guy named Barry Kuser. And that was a fun class because we'd go out every Friday to different places around the Front Range. I think the first place we went was Red Rocks.
Mm-hmm.
And we went around different other different places for the class to just paint from life. We went to downtown Denver. We went all over the place. And Barry was one of those people that was like, he was a good painter. And I mean, he still paints. He's still around.
Yeah.
I think he still teaches there even. And, he kind of taught me the fundamentals of plein air painting and blocking in color, being direct with like your brush strokes and, mm. and like no beating around the bush, just like record what you see as quickly as you can with a big brush and then details come later. And that was like a pretty fun class and eye-opening, but I didn't really get into plein air painting from that class alone. Cause I took the class and I was interested in it, but then I didn't really pursue it other than like, I think I did like one or two paintings after the class, but it just didn't really stick. And then like about 6 or 7 years later, then I started really getting into it on my own.
Yeah, well, I remember when I first met you, there was, and maybe still is, a painting that you did, and it's above the stairs that go down in the basement in your place. And I think my kid said, oh, that's Rem's painting. And I said, well, no, it's not. That's a photo. And she said, this is a painting. So how did you, you know, transition from being hyper interested in the hyper real painting to, you know, plein air?
Because I wanted to be more prolific.
Yeah. You wanted to do more.
Mm-hmm. And, cause the hyper realist stuff takes a long time and I wasn't really producing a whole lot of work, and a lot of it was just commissioned stuff anyway, and I didn't own any of my own work. But sometimes I would just do a painting for fun, like that one. It's like there's a water slide. It's on a lake in upstate New York,
right?
Where my family has a place up there. There's like a water slide and a island and a sailboat. That's one of the only paintings of my own that I actually own.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that one took several months. I don't know how I was 20 years old when I painted that. I don't know how long that would take me if I painted it now, but, I got into plein air painting cause I just wanted to be more prolific.
Who had the idea of painting inside the Altoid canisters?
Nobody knows. I'm sure a lot of people had the same idea and tried it out here and there. I saw a girl named Heidi Annalise painting inside Altoid containers on Instagram. She commented on one of my photos, or she like tagged me in another photo from somebody else who took a picture of me painting plein air painting with, there was like a fire in Boulder. It's like 2017, March, like March 19th or 20th or something, 2017. I remember because it was like the 40th anniversary of the first time the Dead played Fire on the Mountain.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. The first time they played it live, which was like March 18th, 77. Mm-hmm. So I think that fire was sparked on the night of the 18th, and then on the morning of the 19th, that's when I was like painting that, and I thought that was kind of a funny little coincidence that.
Yeah.
But this some random person took a picture of me painting and then tagged me on Instagram, and Heidi saw it, and she tagged me, actually. She mm-hmm. sent it to me, and she's like, "Hey, so look at this. My friends took a picture of you painting." So mm-hmm. I was like, "Who is this girl?"
Yeah.
And I clicked on it and on her profile, and I was like, "Oh, she does like the miniature stuff in Altoids containers."
Mm-hmm.
And I think I had seen her work on Instagram, and I'd seen some other people's work on Instagram I was seeing a few different people painting in Altoids containers. And, I had thought about it one time, like when I worked at Guyrie's at the art store,
right.
And I just thought it was like kind of impractical, but I wasn't thinking about it. Like you'd keep the painting in the lid of the tin, which is what I do. It's like, most of these people do who do it. Like they keep it in the tin with the colors that you painted with. When it crossed my mind once when I was working at the art store, I thought it didn't make any sense. So I was like, why would you use that for like a little painting and then take it out and then clean out the tin and then.
Right. You weren't thinking it'd be permanent in the tin.
No.
Yeah.
And so, cause at that time I was also doing, miniature paintings that were about that size, because at the hardware store, McGuckin Hardware, there was they sell like little canvases that are like 2-inch by 3-inch,
mm-hmm.
and so I had bought a bunch of those around that time, like 2011 or 2012, and painted probably 10 or 15 little paintings, like super hyper realistic. Like I did some trout. Did some like random photographs and whatever. Spent like a long time painting these things. And those are probably more detailed than any of the paintings that I do now.
Yeah.
Because
you want to do more.
Huh?
And be prolific.
Yeah. If you're plein air painting, time is working against you. So the more detailed that you want to make it, the more the light changes. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
You've
gone up to, you know, Chautauqua a lot, and, you know, places in Boulder and other parts of Colorado. But when you go on vacation around the world,
mm-hmm.
then that's one of the things. It seems like that's pretty standard that anywhere you go, you're going to be making.
Yeah. And I guess I have gotten faster at it. So it's like they're pretty detailed anyway, but, I used to be kind of sloppy with it and just have fun and just like, I still do that sometimes,
but
it all depends on the mood and the amount of energy I have. And
have you done any at a concert?
I did one at a concert at the Bluebird one time, and I also did one. I did one at Red Rocks outside of a Tori Amos concert.
Oh yeah.
Last year.
Yeah.
But I wasn't in the concert. I can't think of if I've done one inside of a concert. I don't think so. I did one at the Gold Hill Inn.
Yeah.
There was like a little bluegrass band playing and people dancing and stuff.
Sounds like a concert.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of like a big stadium because we were just talking about Foo Fighters.
The Foo Fighters at Mile High. Yeah.
Nothing like that, but like small venues and did a painting of some, like a classical concert. Like some guys like playing cello and bass and violin. Yeah.
So plein air, you know, literally in French means from life.
Yeah,
so like, it could be anything.
Like open air.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So a lot of people probably pigeonhole it and they say, well, it's a sunset. It's like a field of sunflowers or whatever, but it's life. It's whatever you are witnessing in that moment, you know. It actually reminds me, there's a diner called It's Tops right around the corner from where I lived in San Francisco for many years. And Bob Dylan started doing up plein air. And all of a sudden, there was a post on social media of a painting he did of just the outside of this diner, It's Tops, on Market Street in San Francisco. And I was thinking, like, that would have been wild to be walking down the street and you see Bob Dylan standing there with an easel painting this diner.
Yeah.
But it's really popular. I mean, this has become... I'm sure a lot of people do it, but, you know, how many are, like, really captivating at it?
You know? I don't know. Yeah, I mean... I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying... I'm trying to, with the book right there, you know, I'm trying to teach people how to do it, and...
Yeah.
I'm sure I'm not... I'm definitely not the only person that does it.
Oh, yeah.
I wasn't the first person to do it.
Right.
And miniature painting has been around for a long time,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
In all sorts of forms, like people paint on a grain of rice, people paint on coins, people paint like little lockets, people paint on panels like that size or smaller or bigger.
Yeah.
There's miniature contests all over the world, probably.
Yeah.
Definitely around the country, I know of several.
The ones that you do are so much more than a fad. I mean, they're, you know, there's a reason why, I mean, I would describe your work as viral, you know?
I mean, it's there. It has gone viral a few times.
Yeah. Like, well, tell me about this book. I really want to know about the book.
Well, the book is, I've got a copy right here. It's called Mini Plein Air Painting with Remington Robinson. It's like 144 pages, paperback.
Where is it being sold?
It's being sold on Amazon, and right now it's a bestseller on Amazon.
Wow.
Yeah. Through Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
It's sold at local bookstores all over the place. I know that, like...
The Boulder Bookstore.
The Boulder Bookstore has a bunch. Trident Cafe and Bookstore has a bunch.
So it features your work, but that's not the point. It's more of a how-to.
It's kind of it's basically a how-to. I mean, it's a fun thing to look at. It's like a picture book. There's a ton of pictures. There's a section of setting up a tin so that you can. It's a DIY thing. Like, you'd set it up yourself. There's a chapter on techniques, like basic oil painting techniques. There's a chapter on my process, which is it's not that groundbreaking. It's just like a process of painting, like starting with big shapes and like moving to smaller shapes. And I put maybe my own spin on it with my own explanations.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't take any ideas directly from other people, although I've learned from other people throughout my life. But I basically just wrote the book without really consulting anything, and just, okay, like, what's my process? Like, I think about it and I just write it down. So
yeah.
And then that's the first part is just like setting up a tin, some techniques, and then my process. And then there's 12 painting tutorials from start to finish, like complete paintings, and each each tutorial section is followed by a little gallery of my work, like that relate to that specific thing. So there's like a section on painting at tourist destinations. This one's got Niagara Falls, a few different paintings in Niagara Falls, and then followed by a gallery of paintings at different tourist destinations.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. And then that's pretty much it. It's just a bunch of pictures that are fun to look at. Good for people who want to learn how to paint,
who want to learn how to paint
this particular way.
Yeah.
Or for people who just want to look at something cool. Like you don't have to, you can look at this and you don't have to feel like you need to paint anything ever, you know? So,
like a coffee table book about, you know, jazz musicians. You don't necessarily go out and learn to play jazz.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I want to ask you about music as much as anything, because as you kind of alluded to, how much of a deadhead would you say you are, like on a scale of 1 to 10?
Oh, well, like I have like a, in some ways like a 1, and in other ways like maybe like a 9.
Are you able to, I mean, this might kind of provide us with an answer, but are you able to listen to a dead show and say, oh no, this one sucks, this is like a shitty, this is not a good show?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah?
Yeah, probably. Like, sometimes I'd turn it off.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I don't feel like listening to that. That wasn't a good night.
Yeah.
You know, like, so, like, when I said maybe I'm a 1.
Yeah.
And then maybe I'm a 9. Like, I'm not really, like, into the culture, really.
Right.
I'm not really wearing dead shirts or, like, I don't know, but I like listening to live shows. I don't even really like the new stuff that much. I don't really like Dead and Company, or like, I'm not going around like, you know, like a fiend looking for the next,
the side project,
the next like, you know, band that's playing dead songs, or like hear a dead song on the radio and like, turn it up, it's the Dead. Like, I don't care about that at all. I just want to like listen to, like, if I feel like listening to them, I don't listen to soundboards or like albums or anything almost ever.
You like to hear, like, the crowd noise.
I basically just listen to audience.
Yeah.
Audience tapes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like the re-listen app.
Yeah. It's cool. You showed me that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
very cool. I just like try to find the clearest audience tape with the most amount of crowd noise. Maybe not too much if it's obnoxious, like, but I don't really mind the clapping and the, you know, people talking and stuff. I think that's kind of interesting, like hearing like people from 1980 or something, like just talking about whatever. And
that's interesting.
And then also, but most of the time you're not hearing like tapes that have tons of talking in it. Usually it's just like the energy of the crowd, because like any of the people in the band also said that like the crowd is like part of the band almost.
Yeah,
because the band plays live and like you want to hear the crowd. I want to hear the crowd, at least, because like that's if you cut out the crowd and you just listen to the soundboard recording, like you're taking away half of the experience.
Yeah.
Because like the band is playing and feeding off of the energy of the crowd. And then
there was the time in the 80s when they...
So forth, back and
they
forth.
They played Dark Star for the first time in many, many years, some point in the late 80s, and the sound of the crowd was probably louder than the band. So if you just had the straight-up soundboard of that show, you wouldn't get that energy, you know, which is just as special as the music, you know? But the ultimate for you sounds like the Matrix, where like you have the soundboard and the audience, and then it's mixed.
I like the Matrix, but really, actually, I prefer just a good, clear audience tape.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because sometimes it depends on who mixes the Matrix. Because some people make Matrix tapes that have barely any audience, and it's mostly soundboard.
Yeah. Well, you have been mixing a Grateful Dead.
Yeah, I was. Show. I did like 99% of it, and then I lost interest.
Yeah.
I need to finish that.
Well, let's just say it's a fact that since Jerry Garcia passed away, 1995, there has not been a Grateful Dead. I mean, they literally chose not to like find a new Jerry Garcia. I think there, like, for a hot minute, they thought that David Hidalgo from Los Lobos, that they might hire him.
Oh, really?
And continue. And then it was just like, no, we can't do that. Hmm. And there are side projects, you know, there's Dead and Company, and there's been Further and all these things. But it's strange to me when people say, I'm going to go see the Dead this weekend. I'm like, do you have a time machine? I mean, you know, Trey Anastasio from Phish was on Marc Maron's show, I think last month, and Mark asked him, what do you think about Dead and Company? And he was like, well, John Mayer's a great guy. And then there was like silence. And then Mark said, what do you think about the music? And he said, John's a really good guitar player. And Mark was like pressing him. And he's like, what do you think about Dead and Company? And he was like, it's just not necessary. He's like, I wouldn't want to be in a band that was 100% nostalgia. Like, I like to do new things. And then on top of that, like, he said, just because you play with Mitch Mitchell doesn't make you Jimi Hendrix. And that's how he feels about Dead and Company. I thought that was a good line. It's like, go and enjoy it, but it's kind of strange that, for me at least, it's strange that people go and they think not only, you know, that they're seeing the Grateful Dead, but also that it's even a good tribute, you know, because in a way, I think the best tribute to something would be saying, well, I learned from this and I'm going to do something new.
All those like revival bands, I think pretty much all of the revival, like, I don't know, what would you call it, like the new versions of the Dead, like with the remaining
nostalgia
members, like,
yeah.
But I mean, I think all those versions of the band are missing the most important components. It's not just the music. They're missing the rawness. They're missing the energy.
Yeah.
Like, especially like Dead and Company, like there's energy there, but because Bobby wants to play everything so slow.
Oh God, it's slow.
Some people call it dead and slow.
Yeah.
But because he, like, I don't know why he wants to do that, because, I mean, like, I saw an interview one time, like, with Mickey Hart, and he said that we're a dance band.
Yeah.
Like, and that's not that I like to dance to it, but, like, I like the energy of when they were, like, really on, and then when they're playing with energy and with, like, enthusiasm, and it's raw and it's unexpected, like, that's what I'm always wanting. And then the audience picks up on it, and you can hear, like, when they're in, like, a, whether it's a stadium or a small venue, you can hear that, like, people are just going like ape shit.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it I don't know. It's just so fun to listen to when it's like that. And, what the new bands are missing is like all the effects that Jerry would use. Like, you don't have to be Jerry. Mm. I mean, you're never going to be somebody else.
Right.
The best part about Jerry Garcia was that he was original and he was just himself. Like, if anybody tries to be somebody else, like 99% of the time you're going to fail because yeah. you're trying to be somebody else. But if you're just being yourself, then you can't fail because you're just yourself, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I heard that somewhere else too, by the way. I didn't make that up, but like, so maybe I'm not really being right. myself, but,
no one's completely original.
Yeah. You take ideas from other yeah. sources and put your own spin on it maybe. But yeah. like, what I was going to say is that like the new bands, like John Mayer, for example, like just use some damn effects on your guitar. It's too clean. I don't know.
Oh, he's got like, the Albert King sort of a clean tone. That's true.
Like, I just want to hear like all the different effects on Dark Star or yeah. like, you know, the transition from Scarlet to Fire, like whatever, you know, like,
yeah.
That's why I liked the 89 to 90 with all the like different, I liked
the, all the MIDI
I liked
effects.
The like MIDI yeah, effects. Yeah. And I think that was cool. Yeah. Or like, It almost didn't even seem like he wanted to use the auto wah. He just did that just as a crowd pleaser.
Right, right, right. But one of the things that the people miss in a lot of tribute bands, nostalgia bands, but also, you know, just in the jam band culture that has followed in, you know, the wake of Jerry dying is the darkness, how, you know, the Grateful Dead did a lot of stuff that was really dark
mm-hmm.
and songs that were sad and weird. And, you know, Jerry Garcia and Bob Dylan are two people I can think of in popular music that had a foot in like kind of the old weird America that we might've seen in like Nightmare Alley.
Mm-hmm.
For me, so many of the Grateful Dead associated bands, you know, that have followed the end of the Grateful Dead in 1995, and then also the just jam bands in general. It's too happy. It's just all this one level of like, you know, maybe the best, most applicable. You know, Grateful Dead or 60s related music I hear is the psych rock movement. Bands like the OCs and stuff like that, you know, because it's psychedelic, but it's not just like endless, you know, MDMA happiness. Mm-hmm. But that's just my opinion. But that gets us to our question, which is if you were stranded in a remote Colorado cabin in the event of a zombie apocalypse and all you had was food, water, and a crank-powered Victrola, which five albums would you bring? And is one of them a Grateful Dead album?
Oh, yeah. So, I thought about that a little bit. And I think if it was like a zombie apocalypse thing or whatever, then I would want to bring stuff that like keeps my psyche in order.
Yeah.
So, harmonious music.
Stuff that keeps you from having a absolute break.
Harmonious mm-hmm. music doesn't necessarily mean happy music only.
Right.
Because you can have harmonious music that sounds sad or,
yeah.
or dark or something. But I wouldn't really want too much, disharmony mm-hmm. to disrupt my psyche. Why, because if you have a disturbed psyche, then it's hard to like get anything done.
Mm-hmm.
And, at least for me, like I want to feel, I want to be able to feel productive in that situation mm-hmm. and, optimistic.
So you wouldn't be listening to like a late period Coltrane, you know, this like weird.
No, probably. I don't know. Music. Probably not. Yeah, probably not. But I also, you know, like I probably wouldn't be listening to Nirvana. Like mm-hmm. I liked Nirvana for a long time. And I still like them, but I have had experiences where, like, you know, if I'm listening to too much Nirvana or too much Tool or, I find that I end up doing more destructive behavior, like, to myself or to...
It's a bad influence.
Just a kind of a bad influence in some ways, even just destructive thoughts that would, you know, could maybe lead to like, listlessness, like lack of interest to do anything.
Yeah.
Or to be productive or, but there's other music that opens my mind to, possibilities, and it's not that kind of music.
Okay.
It's like there's other stuff that can like broaden one's horizons and you can feel like free and happy and harmonious. And that's stuff that I would. And it's that's also different for everybody.
The only thing I can think of that fits this description for me is Toots and the Maytals, like the most, you know, pure authentic reggae. But I don't think I would want 5 albums of that. I would get sick of it.
Yeah, yeah. So, and also like you said before this zombie apocalypse, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like.
So you'd be like up in Ward in a cabin and there's no one, it's just you.
Yeah.
You know.
And by the way, I don't think there will be a zombie apocalypse. I don't think that's possible. But at the same time, I think that we already are in a zombie apocalypse in a way. There's like
with our phones?
People on their phones.
Yeah.
And and then like the opioids.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And yeah, so that's the people who are all jacked up on fentanyl and wandering around, they're kind of zombies, you know, just as much as people who are on their phones and just not paying attention to anything. Like I hate seeing people cross the street.
Oh God.
Looking at their phone. Like, pay attention. There could be somebody who's also looking at their phone, driving their car, running the red light.
Yeah. Well, it disturbs. I'm sure
that's happened.
Me, one of the most disturbing things to me is being in a room with a bunch of people who are all on their phones and being the only one who's disturbed. Uh-uh. Like, doesn't anybody else realize that this is a horrible thing and you are kind of engaging in zombie behavior, you know? But as far as a literal zombie apocalypse, I think The Last of Us was in... One of the reasons why it was really effective is, you know, the way that they explain how scientifically, you know, the way that there are zombie ants, like that is a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to do with heat and then, you know, this wood that goes through their brains and then, you know, they're sick.
Mm.
I think that was one of the reasons why The Last of Us was so successful is because it's like, no, this makes sense. maybe it won't happen, but there is a one in a zillion chance that mm-hmm. there could be a disease of some kind that would render most of civilization as effectively zombies.
Yeah.
You know?
But by the way, I want to point out that what I do encourages people to look at their phones.
Yeah, we can talk about that
and,
later.
And I hope that there any of you who are watching or listening to this are not like crossing the street looking at my Instagram stuff right. while you're looking at your phone
right.
crossing the street or driving while don't look at my very engaging painting videos while you're yeah. driving your car.
Yeah. Save I mean, I like the fact that lots of people have said to me, oh, I listened to your podcast while I was on a run or I was on a hike or I was cleaning the house, you know, and it's not something that renders somebody, you know, incapacitated, you know, by endless scrolling.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody looks at, you know, a post that you did and is inspired to go out in nature and see that spot that you painted, or even to pick up some paints and try it, that's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if something that we see on the internet, TikTok, probably more than anything, if something that we see inspires us to scroll even more, then is it really inspiring? I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, what is album number one?
Maybe I'll go backwards from five to
sure.
down to one. Yeah, actually, yeah. It's not. I do have a number one,
okay.
and all the rest of them are kind of, they don't really have an order. But I will save number one for last.
Okay.
So definitely an Eric Johnson album.
The Cliffs probably, of Dover?
Probably Avia Musicom. Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, that album. Because I think I've come back to that album like since seventh grade. I think I first heard about
wow.
that. And then I've come back to it here and there ever yeah. since then. And there's, it's kind of cheesy, but it brings good
oh yeah
thoughts and feelings.
A lot of joy in Eric Johnson's
playing. I've got a lot of like good memories tied to that.
Have you seen him live?
I have, and I got to meet him.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. Got to shake his hand. Very soft.
There was like there was a tour of the Guitar Gods, and I think it was like Eric Johnson, Steve Vai, and Satriani.
Yeah, G3. They're actually redoing that tour
oh, yeah.
soon. Maybe they already did it. I hope I didn't miss it.
But wait a second. You were just talking about not liking a clean tone. What can be cleaner than Eric Johnson?
I don't know. I mean, it depends on the music.
Right, right.
Like with
that music is meant for a clean tone.
With the Grateful yeah. Dead, I like yeah. there is clean stuff from 72, 74.
Yeah.
You know, like...
The cocaine years. Yeah.
Is that what that
oh,
was?
Oh, sure. yeah. It's like the pre-heroin, Jerry.
Mm-hmm. But,
yeah.
I mean... But yeah, Eric Johnson's the king of tone.
Yeah.
They call him.
Oh, it's beautiful.
He's got, and he doesn't use only clean tone. He's got a lot of good clean tone, but he's got some really nice dirty distortion going on in
yeah.
some stuff. And it's just, but like some fat, some thin, some like scratchy, some like pure, like sounds like a violin mm. almost.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
It's like a David Gilmour tone as well. They both play strats, right?
Oh, David. Yeah, like, shoot. I didn't actually think about Pink Floyd when I was... Because I grew up listening to Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
When I was like, thinking about my five albums, I didn't really think about that. Mm. But,
well, you can
but yeah, like...
You can change it right now.
I
you haven't said
it.
Your five, so...
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
But... No, like, yeah, I think... So Avia Musicom or Tones or Venus Isle, those are also good, but probably Avia Musicom.
The Cliffs of Dover must be one of the last hit songs that was just a guitar jam.
Yeah.
I can't think of
it. And then there was a renaissance with Guitar Hero when that came out.
Oh, right.
A lot of the younger generation found out about Cliffs of Dover from that.
Yeah.
But And that's, they're not even the younger generation anymore. You know, that was like, that
those
was
people
like
15, are like 30 now. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true.
15 years ago or 18 years ago or something.
What are you, like 35?
I'm 38.
38?
Yeah.
Okay.
But, Cliffs of Dover is not even my favorite track
well,
on that album.
Well, that's just the one that everybody
it's just the one that everybody knows. That's probably the one that, if you name Eric Johnson, they probably say Cliffs of Dover. They're not going to say any other song or tune or whatever.
Yeah.
But,
okay, that's album.
Does it have to have lyrics to be called a song?
No, of course not.
Okay.
Duke Ellington had like 1,000 amazing songs, and, you know, some of them had singing, but, you know.
Yeah, I feel like to be called a song, it has to have lyrics or words. But whatever.
No,
minutia. So another one. Something by Bjork.
Which one?
Either post Vespertine or Homogenic.
Okay, and...
Or debut. I don't know.
Some of her stuff has, I would say chaos is the right word, but, you know, eccentricity on a level that might sometimes be unsettling,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah, I mean, if you're listening to Homogenic, mm-hmm. Pluto, towards the end of the... So it's like the second to last track. That's like pure chaos. So, if you're trying to be peaceful, don't listen to that.
Yeah.
But then there's Vespertine, which is pretty much. Yeah, that's like that's probably the one that I would bring on the zombie apocalypse. Yeah. Maybe.
That was chosen. One other time on the shows, it was Adam from Murder by Death chose that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then there's Family Tree, which is like an album of hers that's like, it's kind of like an all-encompassing thing with stuff from hers from the Sugar Cubes. And then,
right. But which one would you want in your zombie cabin up in Ward?
Probably Vespertine.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Although... Yeah, sure.
Okay, final answer.
Yeah, or debut. Vespertine or debut, so... yeah, probably Vespertine.
Okay.
Who cares?
All right, album number 3.
You know, it might be this playlist that I... It's not really an album. It could be... There's this playlist that I had... It's on my old computer. I took an appreciation of music class when I was in college.
Yeah.
And it's just a playlist of a bunch of classical music.
Mm-hmm.
The Moldau, I really like, by Bedřich Smetana.
You're going to have this made into a vinyl record somehow. Get it up to you. Get up to the cabin.
Yeah,
that might be tough, especially in a pinch. If it's like, hey, you know, this apocalypse is happening, here's your chance, you gotta grab a bag. It's mm-hmm. like, wait a second, I gotta download all the MP3s of this and then somehow get it pressed onto a vinyl record. I can't leave yet.
Well, yeah, it might be like a thing where it's like you got a solar panel and you got your laptop.
Yeah, and, there you go.
But then everything got deleted except for this 5.
Right.
So that's...
Right. Right.
It'd have to be my old laptop, too, because it's, like, got everything downloaded onto it.
Yeah.
Like when you could do that, it's almost becoming a thing that we're... It's almost like they're trying to get rid of that possibility.
Right. The only time that I really held anybody explicitly to these rules was when Clay... from Gasoline Lollipops, he interviewed me. I was the guest on the show, and I was like, you know what? I'm only going to choose albums that I literally own on vinyl. That's my, you know, to hold myself to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but anybody else, that's fine. But what artists or songs were on this playlist?
I only remembered that playlist when I was on my way over here, and I haven't listened to it in a long time. So the Moldau was one by Smetana, and he's a Czech composer and from the Czech Republic, Czechoslovakia.
Yeah.
But I can't remember what the other ones were. Maybe like Spring, Four Seasons, or
Stravinsky.
Mm. Yeah. I don't know if the Nutcracker was on there, Tchaikovsky, or not. But could have been Brahms, or could have been like some Mozart.
Some of that could be good battle music. You know, if you're battling the zombies, they find you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so okay, that would be three. What's number four?
I could maybe say there's this album, Arcadia by Ramona Lisa.
What's that? Ramona Lisa?
Yeah.
Okay. What kind of music is it?
She calls it pastoral electronic music.
Hmm. Where's she from?
Well, it's really Caroline Polachek. She's from Connecticut, and we were friends in college.
Yeah.
And then she moved to New York, and then she was in a band called Chairlift. They started here and they started in Boulder, and then they moved to Brooklyn and became, you know, big and famous and important.
I'm gonna have to check this out. We also have a playlist up by year. So any album that somebody chooses on Mile High Stash, we put one of the songs from that album on the playlist.
Hmm.
So I'll put that on there.
Yeah, that's... but she was in Chairlift, and then that was like her first solo album, I think, maybe. Mm-hmm. But went under the pseudonym Ramona Lisa. Only made that one album. And I think I've listened to that like so many times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why would this music be good for the zombie cabin?
I wouldn't say it's good for everybody, but like at the same time, I think a lot of people would like that album. Mm-hmm. I've just listened to it a bunch, and I've got, I don't know, good feelings associated with that, and good memories and stuff.
Yeah. Is there singing in this?
Pastoral electronic? Yeah. I think there's singing in every track except maybe for one.
Huh.
Okay. But I think she recorded the whole thing on her laptop, like all the vocals and everything, and like had like a little MIDI keyboard on her laptop, and. And just did it while she was on tour with her band.
Mm.
And I don't know what song you would maybe put in that podcast. I mean, not the podcast, but in the playlist.
Yeah, the Spotify playlist.
Mm-hmm. Could be, I don't know. We could talk about it later, maybe.
Yeah. Okay, so drum roll, what is, you know, the absolute must-have number one?
I think this could maybe be my favorite album of all.
Okay.
It's My Secret Heart by Michael Whalen.
I don't know this.
It's some people might call it spa music.
Spa music.
But it brings my...
Is it ambient music?
It's like ambient piano.
Okay.
It brings my consciousness home, kind of type of... It like brings me into like a serene environment, inner environment.
Yeah.
And it creates like a space where I'm able to like be completely free and focus and concentrate and relax, but also like gain might over myself.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are you into Brian Eno?
I should be. My friend Nick is really into Brian Eno, and he always talks about Brian Eno. Yeah. But
I did a whole thesis and presentation in college on Brian Eno's life and discography, and then his work as a producer too. But like his music he made in the 70s, music for airports, music for films, The Pearl, The Plateau of Mirror, all this stuff. It was the first music I think like directly described as ambient. And also it was described as like furniture music, which is kind of what you're saying. It's like, it's not distracting you, but it's also, you're also in it. It's just something that's here. It's kind of around you. Mm-hmm. So you can do other stuff. You could paint, you could do homework, you could do whatever in it. And it's just kind of there. But when you were saying before that you would want music that didn't necessarily try to put you in a good mood, but maybe kind of encapsulate everything. I was thinking of Music for Airports by Eno, because he was traveling the world on tour with, I think, Roxy Music when he was in Roxy Music, and he noticed that every airport was playing music that was so expressly trying to say, you're not going to die, you're not going to die, you're not going to die. And he was like, what I want to do is make instrumental music and have it played at airports. And the message would be, it's possible that you're going to die, but it doesn't really matter. And he wanted every airport in the world to play it. And the Amsterdam airport, I think, was the only one that said, this is a good idea. And for a few years, they actually played that. And that was Music for Airports from the day that my daughter was born until like maybe last year. She listened to that to fall asleep every single night.
Hmm.
Yeah. But I got to check out this Michael Whalen.
And I got to check out Brian Eno.
Yeah.
I feel like I've probably... I always forget about him too. Yeah, Brian Eno.
He's really the world's most interesting man. You know, there's those commercials for like Dos Equis, the world's most interesting man. Brian Eno, like not just his own music, but the way that he transformed a lot of other artists. There was like Talking Heads, and then Talking Heads after they worked with Eno. David Bowie, and then David Bowie after he worked with Eno. And then the same for like U2. A lot of other bands. Mm-hmm. It's just a really interesting guy, you know.
But yeah, there's a quote I really like. It's I always remain relaxed and thereby gain might over myself.
Yeah.
And so, because when you're not relaxed, you can just like be taken this way and that.
Mm-hmm.
Like people are really driven by. The people are really affect driven. They will allow anything to steer them in any direction. And some people really seek that out almost, but then it backfires. Like when if they're on an airplane that's crashing, then they'll do what everybody else does and panic. And that's why you have herd mentality when people are like in a panicky sort of situation and everybody's like trying to leave. And, but then the doors are, That's why in code, in building code, you have doors are supposed to be, they're supposed to swing out,
mm-hmm.
because if there's a fire or something, people are trying to leave, and the doors should swing out because there have been cases where doors swing in,
mm-hmm.
and because everybody's trying to leave because of the fire, they won't actually back up to. They can't back up because everybody's pushing,
yeah.
because everybody's all affected by the fire and trying to just get out as quick as possible. But then everybody dies because
right.
they're all trapped in there because the doors don't swing out. They swing in. But,
if you were on an airplane and it was going down and Brian Eno's Music for Airports was playing, everybody mm-hmm. might just say,
well, it's hard. Okay. It's hard to also imagine that how it would actually play out in real life because it's easy to imagine things when you're sitting in a nice room like this and yeah. just like on a comfy chair and everything's peaceful and nothing's wrong. But it's a completely different scenario when it is a real world situation. I would like to think that I'd be relaxed when I'm on a crashing plane.
Yeah.
But who knows? But at the same time, I was talking about this with somebody the other day. Like, if I was on a crashing plane, I would want to be like happy, not necessarily happy, but like I'd want to be relaxed and like soak it in. You know, soak in the experience because it's going to be like your last one.
Might as well be a good experience. Yeah.
Not necessarily good, but it's going to be your last experience.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, like I try to remain relaxed because then I can have might over myself, over my consciousness, over my like thoughts, over my feelings. At least it's something to aspire to. It's not, it doesn't always work out that way, but it's a skill, I guess, to build up.
I've thought about this a lot and talked about it a lot. When I'm on a plane, I don't fear death. I fear those minutes of panic and chaos, you know, when everybody realizes that we're going to die. So maybe I should just work on being able to find peace, and then I would have peaceful death either way. I'd be fine. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find peace in painting?
Yeah.
Yeah.
For the most part, yeah. I've also learned to.
Yeah.
The more, as I've gotten older, as I've painted more and more, I've like gotten more peace out of it. Mm. When I was younger, I used to, like when I was like in my 20s, and I didn't paint that much in my teens, but like in my 20s, when I would paint, I felt restless all the time. And I just like had so much energy. I just wanted to like do anything but like sit there for hours and paint. Mm. Like I was just squirming in my seat.
Like you saw it as work.
I sort of saw it as work, in a way, but I mean, it was satisfying and rewarding when it turned out well.
Mm.
And I could sort of get into a meditative state, I think. Mm. 'Cause anytime you're concentrating on anything, I think you're in a meditative state, whether you're driving or painting or like working in the garden, playing music.
Yeah.
Like, even if you're like writing a paper or like crunching numbers,
don't say that to a Buddhist, because they'll tell you that if you're doing anything, then you're not actually meditating. You have to be. And it's not like the goal of meditating is to think about nothing. It's more to, you know, really be in that moment, sitting there, and whatever comes.
Mm-hmm.
Let it go, you know. But I've heard a lot of people have arguments about this, because when like a hardcore Buddhist hears somebody say, well, I was working in the garden and it was very meditative, they say, well, you were doing something, you know. Because I've said, oh, you know, when I go on bike rides and I, you know, I spend the day cycling up to Ward or Nederland or something, it's very meditative. It's like, well, you're actually doing something.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were concentrating, you know, really hard on a painting or writing a paper or making it on your bike up Magnolia Road, you know, to Nederland or something, there can be meditative aspects of it, you know, but you haven't really let go, like completely let go.
Yeah, but yeah. Who says that meditation has to be letting go? I guess who says that? Buddhists say that,
right?
But I'm not a Buddhist, and yeah. I've learned from good meditation teachers who are not Buddhist at all.
Yeah.
But I have said that there's two kinds of meditation.
Mm.
There's the meditation where you sit and meditate. Mm-hmm. And then there's the other kind where it's just your daily life when you're concentrating on mm-hmm. something in the waking state. And most people don't consider that meditation, maybe especially not Buddhists. But
some people call it like mindfulness. That's another word for it.
Yeah, you could call it mindfulness, yeah. but you could call it concentration. But I think there's a thing called like the permanent state daily meditation or something like that, where you're basically just being mindful throughout your entire day, and just trying to execute everything in the correct form, whatever it is. And there's probably a lot of situations where it's hard to do that. Like you'd probably have to pause that to like have some kind of an interaction with, if you're in a stressful situation, you don't want to be just like trying to practice this if you're like working on your own, like what I do, most of the time, I'm on my own.
Well, I think that would be success in a way in meditating. If there was such a thing as success in meditating, is if you could take that feeling of just being and letting go into everything, you know, that you do, whether it was parenting or you know, working at your job, or maybe you know, finding a sense of peace on a plane that's crashing, you know,
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Yeah.
How have you found, you know, a way to combine or entwine, you know, you're making art with making a living?
Well, I've sold paintings to be able to make money so that I can live.
But how do you not lose your sense of, you know, passion and artistry in saying, well, I also need to sell.
So I basically stopped doing commissions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How does that feel?
Feels amazing.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I mean, I like making people happy when I can do a commission and they appreciate it and it's well received, but at the same time I prefer to, in order, it's kind of like to keep it sustainable. That's kind of why I stopped doing commissions, so I can do my own work at my own pace, and just focus on that and see where that can go. And it seems to be working in the sense that like a lot of people want to buy that stuff. So I mean, if you could, you know, if you could choose between, if you can sell work, if you can sell the work that you want to make and sell the work that you don't necessarily want to make that somebody else wants you to make, I think for me, I would at least want to try to sell the work that I want to make instead of being, you know, used for somebody else's idea.
What advice would you give as someone who, you know, has become, it seems like you're an expert in social media. Like, what advice would you give, you know, an artist who wants to get their career off the ground by getting, you know, a following on social media? Because I think a lot of people say, like, I don't know where to start, or I'm trying this or that, and it's just not working.
Well, first of all, I don't know if I'm an expert at social media, but it's worked in some ways for me. So, but I think one thing, find a niche.
Mm-hmm.
I found a niche with the Altoid things.
Yeah.
But at that particular time, I was lucky to have found it and started doing it, when I did. I don't know if it would even work right now if I were to start doing it right now, and nobody had been really doing it that much, or maybe a few people, if it would work or not. But find it, like, try it out, different things, and then whatever starts to work, whatever you can sort of see if it's working, if people are commenting on it, or if it's like getting lots of likes compared to the other post or whatever, then be prolific.
Yeah.
And being prolific is important, because people see so much stuff anyway on social media and in their daily life, whether it's on TV or just driving your car down the street and like looking at all sorts of things, and like, and then there's billboards and like advertisements, and like everybody's like trying to just shove things in your face all the time, and you're like, I don't know what to look at, you know? Mm-hmm. So, but to be prolific is important, because I have thought about like this person, standing on the side of, train tracks, and imagine a really long train's coming by and you don't know when it's going to end. But each train car has like an image on it, you know? And this is like a marketing thing. It's like
every image is
everything is different. And then let's say you're somebody who's putting out something out there in the world, and you're not prolific, and your image is only one of those 500 train cars. It's like, wow. Like, okay, this person puts all their love and everything into this thing, and they put it out there, but it's only one of those train cars. And it might be the most amazing thing you saw on a train car, but then it's like, there's so many other things that one amazing car is long gone after only a few seconds.
Yeah. Well, maybe it was bad timing as well. Like, it was the very last car and nobody saw it.
Yeah, it could be the last car.
Yeah.
But let's think about just like the middle of the train car, you know, or the middle of the train. It's like cars coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. And then like, if you can put things out, if you can be prolific and you're putting things out there more and more, it's like, oh, that one. Oh, I remember that from before somehow. I saw that. Oh, look, if you 30 seconds later, oh, there's another one.
And you know it's the same artist, because, you know, it's not disparate. It's not like, you know, everything by that artist was a completely different genre. It's not all the same image, but you can tell it's the same artist.
Yeah, so you, like, being prolific, no matter what it is, there's value in that, because the more people see something, the more that they, and then also, like, the more you do anything, the more people think that that's what you do. It's like, it's like so dumb. Yeah. It's like, but it's true. Like I could like stop painting and just hang it up and not paint anything anymore, and then just start like being a carpenter, you know, and just like start fixing things, and then maybe put like flyers out there saying that like I'm a handyman and I can like fix things in your house.
Mm-hmm.
You could use the same principles there, and you could start a business doing that. And you could, and as long as you do what you say, that's probably another one too, is do what you say, follow through.
Yeah.
Right. But like being prolific, putting your stuff out there for people to see, like putting stuff on the telephone pole here and there, like, and then the more you do it, the more people think that that's what you do. It's like, oh, I'm not really a carpenter. I'm an artist, but I'm just like being a carpenter now. And then, who's this guy? He's the carpenter. No, not, I'm an artist. No, you're a carpenter. Cause you're a handyman. You're like going around and fixing everybody's stuff and you're making money at it. Oh, I guess I'm doing pretty well. You know, it's like you could just start any business that you want to, or just start making money doing anything, as long as you do what you say and you put yourself out there and you do it a lot.
And it has to be quality work.
Yeah. Work is good.
You can promote the hell out of anything, but if it's not very good, it's not going to matter anyway.
Yeah. If it helps people, that also helps too. You know, it's like as an artist, I'm hopefully helping people like by making, I'm not really helping people, but maybe in a little small way. It's like people are, I'm making imagery that is, I don't know, it's nice to look at, you know, I'm not making like bloody clowns or something, like, you know.
That's a good band name too. The Bloody Clowns.
The Bloody Clowns.
Yeah. Right. How do you find a balance, let's say on Instagram, as a visual artist or even a band, you know, when you're trying to be prolific and you also don't want to inundate and make people sick of you?
Oh. Well, I do paint a lot more than I post. But I think it's good to post, probably good to post once a day or once every couple days. I should take my own advice on that. I haven't really been posting that much in the last, in the last few months. But also that's because of the move coming up.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that as we wrap up and then, you know, hopefully I see you and our kids get to see each other in the next, what are you moving like a week from now?
Oh, I think it's in like 12 days.
12 days.
Or a week and a half, something like that.
Okay. Rem and his family are moving temporarily, but to Paris, France. And
for a year.
For a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. So not indefinitely, but not for a few months, you know.
It'll feel like that, you know, it's going to go by pretty quick.
But I don't know. Our kids are going to miss each other a lot.
Yeah. Maybe we can do some Zoom
stuff,
you know.
I really want them to bring back postcards. Like, you know, I brought that up the other day.
Mm-hmm.
It's really fun, you know, to get mail, especially when it comes from a foreign country.
I'll try to remember that and try to send some postcards from Paris.
But the response that I got was, well, no, we'll be able to text. It's like, yeah, but what about this other thing too? Mm-hmm. Like, this would be fun. Anyway, how does that feel, and how are you going to transition, you know, not only as a family and a member of a family, but also as, you know, as an artist and as a kind of an entrepreneur as well?
Well, as a family, it should be interesting. I mean, the whole thing is because of Tara's job.
Yeah.
She's a physicist, and she's like the star of the show. I'm kind of just taking a back seat on this one, even though I am going to be painting a lot. But this is kind of her dream and her goal to do something like this.
Yeah.
Maybe not necessarily Paris, but you know, I think it would have been great to be in Paris 100 years ago.
Oh yeah.
But now I'm sure it's still pretty good, you know. But yeah. Lucia is like, she's a little bit screwed because she's going to an all French school and she doesn't speak French.
For freshman year of high school.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
That's a big deal.
She's gotta like know like literature and like geography and but she is going to be in small class sizes.
That's
it's
good.
Like 12 to 16 students per class, I think.
Yeah.
And
how much French do you know?
Just a little bit, not
plein air, basically.
Plein air.
Have you gone back and read, you know, a Movable Feast or any Hemingway books?
I don't even know what that is.
Just
Hemingway?
Just to get the nostalgia for the, you know, the 20s Paris.
No.
That's probably a good idea.
Yeah, I haven't really been reading anything. No, I should.
I'm such a dork. Like, even when, you know, I was just in a few places in France last year, but like anytime I'm even going somewhere on the plane, I'm reading some novel about how it used to be there, which is like, it's kind of a dorky romantic thing, because it's not going to be like that anyway. So.
Yeah, I am going to paint a lot though in Paris though, but I can't really say that I've been that excited for the trip.
Yeah,
because it was so much bureaucracy and work to make the whole thing possible that it actually didn't seem like it was even going to happen a few weeks ago.
Yeah, yeah, I heard that.
But the visas worked out.
That's
and
awesome.
Everything's been sort of happening, falling into place. But we've been trying. Only because we've been trying to make it happen.
Have you seen the Notre Dame before?
We came, yeah.
In person?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just love the gargoyles. They're so stunning. And I'm really excited to see your paintings of France and, you know, capture the darkness as well.
Like, yeah.
Like we were saying before, like, those weird effects, not just the joy, you know?
Yeah. There'll be some, maybe some more like limited color palette stuff that kind of helps with creating that effect in painting.
Mm.
Like, maybe like something with like white and burnt sienna and sepia and that's it. Or just, maybe I always like the secondary color scheme with like, orange, green, and purple, some kind of variation of that.
Do you like churches?
Yeah. I mean, like this, well, not necessarily churches because of them being churches, but because of the architecture, some of them. Yeah.
I liked going around Paris and seeing the different versions of St. Michael in different churches. You know, there was stone and there's some wooden ones and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
As an artist, that'd be really fun to go around and paint different churches.
As a painter, I don't really like subject matter as much as I like light. And, because you can have the same subject at different times of day, and there's like one time where it just looks amazing, and then later it just doesn't look like anything. It's blah, it just looks boring. Right, you don't want to even look at it.
Yeah. One of the reasons why I would really like to live in France or almost anywhere in Europe someday is that these other countries and other completely different cultures are so close.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you guys...
Oh, yeah.
Like instead of saying, let's spend the weekend in Aspen or let's spend the weekend in Vail or, you know, Breckenridge, you can say, let's spend this weekend in Greece, and then next weekend we'll go to Italy.
The train system is like so much better.
Oh, it's amazing.
So you can just get on the channel from Paris and be in London in like an hour or something? Or like under 2 hours, maybe?
Yeah. But you can also take, you know, Ryanair or something for $20 and end up in Lisbon, you know. So that'll be great. I'm excited to see your depictions of Europe and hopefully get our kids on a postcard trip.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking with me. I'm excited for your audience to, you know, check out our talk, and then also to have my audience for the first time in a while listen to an interview with somebody who's not necessarily in the music world.
Yeah.
It's been a while. We had visual artist, Lexi Baker, and then a tattoo artist from Rising Tide in Boulder, but that was a while ago.
Yeah, I'm not in the music world, but I could be.
You're very much into music in a hardcore way.
Yeah, I mean, I've been playing guitar since I was 10.
Yeah. Well, and it sounds like your art, making art for you, is synonymous with listening to music.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah.
What is the best way for people to see your art and get in touch with you?
The best way to see it is on Instagram, @ Remington Robinson.
Okay.
And then to get in touch with me, send me a DM. Although, like, you know what? I was actually really sad recently when I realized that I was getting a ton of DMs.
They were all hidden.
Oh. Ugh. I was so upset because, like,
what's your email address?
It's just remrobinson@gmail.
There you go.
Yeah. I think my email address is even maybe on my website somewhere, but I'm not.
What's your website?
I'm not sure. It's just remingtonrobinson.com.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
And the book is available everywhere now.
Yeah, it's absolutely everywhere. It's available everywhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Cool. And, you know, someday we'll do another episode and we'll just talk about aliens the whole time. I didn't even ask you. I didn't even ask about...
I know.
Any of that. Yeah. So,
well, I'm not going to talk about it unless I'm asked.
Yeah, yeah. I'll come to Paris and just interview you about that. That'll be good. Yeah, yeah. Awesome. Thank you for sitting down with me, Rem.
Thank you for having me, Adam.
I'll give you another hour, then I gotta run, I gotta fly away. Leave you to fall, leave you to stuff your flowers and a shotgun.
That was painter, music lover, and longtime squirrel caretaker, Remington Robinson. Check out his new book and check out his work at remingtonrobinson.com and on Instagram. I hope to visit Rem and his family in Paris sometime in the next year. I was just there last year, and I have some friends in France, but not in Paris at the moment, so it'd be cool to go out there and get shown around a little. If you're in Colorado, I hope to see you at the Fox Theater in Boulder Sunday, September 22nd, when I play with Hunter Stone. In the meantime, get in touch with me anytime via milehighstash.com with any questions, comments, concerns, worldly advice, psychological help, you know, donations, whatever you got. And please, I'll be saying this again, but please vote. Wanna rise above duality, you wanna transcend day and night. Yes, I'm old fashioned, I just don't share your passion for ever changing eternal twilight. Go on. Give oblivion a shot. You go on and fade to gray. You got to. Maybe you'll do better without God, and maybe I'll do better without you. Well, I wish that were true, and I wish that were you.
sitting across from me instead of this impersonation of who you used to be. Everything that we were comes down to this. And all we built sinking ships. By tomorrow we'll both just be shadows on the wall. Take me back before we lost it all. I wanna go back to Montauk. To Montauk.